Beer Talk. Gespräche über und beim Bier.
Hello and welcome to another episode of our podcast Beer Talk. Today is the first time that we do a podcast whilst driving in a car. Very funny. So I'm curious how it works, but I'm very happy to have Kjetil Gikjun next to me. He is quite a famous brewing icon from Norway. Some people say he's the one who brought the flavor to the country. So we will explore that. Okay. And he was also a pilot. So a very, very interesting story. And I'm happy to be here. And maybe you tell us something about you.
I'm very happy to be here with you, Marcus. I think we met the first time in Blumenau judging in Brazil, maybe in 2013, I'm just guessing.
Something like that, yes.
So that's 13 years ago.
No, long, long time ago.
It's a while.
Perfect. Yeah. Yesterday you told me that you brewed the highest ever brewed beer in the world. So maybe we start with that because that is like a world record.
Okay.
So how did that come and where was it and how was the beer?
Well, me and a friend, we decided to take a Japanese K truck, a very small underpowered truck, and drive it in the Mongol Rally from Norway to Kazakhstan.
Wow.
And then we passed the Pamir Highway, the Pamir Mountains in Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan. Beautiful area, by the way. Yeah, and we realized, hey, we're passing some pretty high terrain here. So we thought, why don't we talk to Kegland, which my friend works with, a supplier of homebrew equipment, and ask them if they want to sponsor us, and then we will brew the highest brew ever taking place in the world.
Wow.
At 4,655 meters altitude or elevations. And we did exactly that, and it worked out very well. It was a lot of fun, but feeling altitude sickness and getting very sunburned with high UV radiation or, you know, up at high elevation, it was cool. Yeah. Super nice.
And you had to bring everything, also the equipment? And
of course, everything, absolutely everything. Our challenge up there is that, of course, high up, almost at the mountain top, you don't have much water, do you?
Yeah.
Because water goes with gravity and we're on top of it. So we had the water for the brewing and we needed to sparge with cold water. And as for cooling, we didn't really have much ways to do that. So we just had to bring it down to lower elevation and let it cool slowly in bags, in plastic bags, made for the purpose.
So there was no ice around?
There was no ice around, no.
Unbelievable. And what were the differences if you brew that high in terms of temperature, maybe in terms of fermentation or whatever?
Yeah, it's quite simple, I think. At that elevation, the wort boils at 84 degrees Celsius. So at that temperature, you get less bitterness out of the hops, but you get more hop aroma. It doesn't evaporate off the aromas. So now these days where the trend is lower bitterness, smoother beer with more hop aroma, that nailed it very well. So we brewed a pale ale. We fermented it while we were driving. We took it to Kazakhstan and served it in, I think it was called the Ginger Bar, in Almaty. 3 weeks later, and it worked out very well. It was very smooth, hop aromatic, worked well.
Fantastic. So that cries out for a repeat even higher. Do you have any idea about that?
Yeah, you know what? There are higher roads crossing mountain passes, especially in India, and it would be very attractive to go there and to do something crazy again at like 6,000 meters or something.
You know? Wow, so you have a plan. and it's also close to maybe the beginning, because when you started with the whole beer thing, you were a pilot. So you were already in the hate, let's say it like this. And how did you come to the beer idea? Because being a pilot is not the worst job in the world.
No. It was not about finding a new career at all. It just ended up this way. No, I was, I'm generally interested in culinary arts and cooking and all these things. And I wanted to understand more about beers. And as a pilot, I was flying into intercontinental routes. I flew to the United States a lot. And now we're talking back in the 1990s. In Europe in the 1990s, it's more difficult to find a beer bar where you would have a huge range of beers. You can go to Germany and have German beers, or even regional German beers. You can go to Belgium and have Belgian beers, and so on. But in the US, I can walk into a bar and I can start with a German beer. I can go via an American IPA to a Belgian something, and then to finish with an ESB from the UK. You know, so everything was available, and I was able to familiarize myself with all these different beer styles. And as I did that, then I became more curious about how do they actually make these beers. and I started homebrewing. Again, not much homebrewing equipment in Norway at that time, 1990s. So I bought everything from the US. We didn't have any weight restrictions on the suitcases or baggage checking in as a pilot. So I put a sack of malt in my suitcase, you know, and I brought fresh yeast, which I asked in the cabin crew if I could keep cold in the galley. And I brought everything from the US back to Norway and started brewing. At that time, you know, there was no internet. So everything was about buying books with recipes, learning how to homebrew the old-fashioned way.
It sounds like a really fascinating story.
What happened is that I served my beers to friends and relatives, and they liked it, but they had no references. So if I've served them something like a porter or an IPA, they would say, "Ah, yeah, this is good." But they had no references. They didn't know how what to compare it with. So I realized nobody understood me. And when I submitted my best IPA ever to the Norwegian National Competition for Homebrewers, and there were, I think in the light ale category, which was like the group where the IPA belonged, there were 14 entries that year. Maybe this was back in 1999. And my IPA, which I was so proud of, an American IPA, ended up at 13th place. It was the second worst beer according to the judges. And their comment was that it was too hoppy and too hop aromatic. And I realized that their reference about IPAs were English IPAs, not American IPAs. So I realized that even the so-called professional judges in Norway did not understand beer. And then I became really annoyed and a little bit angry maybe. And I thought somebody must take the responsibility for learning the Norwegian population about beer. And I approached another homebrewer, and together we started Nøgne Brewery, just not to earn money, not to get employment for ourselves, but just to educate Norwegians and try to change the beer landscape.
It's a bit like talking a different language. And maybe just back to the piloting again, just a moment. At that time, you were able, if you were having these intercontinental flights, that you could stay a while at your destinations, and it was also okay to go into bars and have some beers. But because nowadays I think people would be a bit looking strange if you have a pilot sitting at a bar having 5-6 beers and coming back to the airport. But that was no problem at that time.
You know, if you stay for 24 or 48 hours, then you have the opportunity to do that, especially with the 48 and the 72 hour stops. That's very relaxed.
Did you have any favorite beer at that time in the US?
Not really at that time. Initially, it took me a long time to crack the code to understand hoppy American IPAs, for example. They were far from my favorites, even though I realized how important they were in the landscape at the moment. I try not to have favorites because the world is full of so many good products, and you should respect them all. As long as they're good, respect them.
Absolutely. But your first beer when you had grown up, was it like a light lager, or what did you have?
Yeah, that was everything which was available in Norway. That was light lagers, maybe an occasional German Weissbier, but not very available. Just, you know, you could find them.
Okay, and is it true, as I already said in the introduction, people say you brought the flavor in the Norwegian or even Scandinavian beer world. So with your new company, that was the thing that happened?
Yeah, we were the first in Norway to make an IPA commercially, to make a saison, to make an imperial stout. And we were probably among the first to barrel age. We were among the first to do sours. I mean, we did a lot of firsts.
You tried everything almost.
Not everything, but we were pretty innovative. But having said that, like, okay, it sounds cool to be the first and to be alone and to break ground, but it was a very lonely task, and almost nobody understood us. So it was when other breweries were inspired by us. I say inspired because the negative thought would be, they're copying us, or they're just riding free on what we started to pave the way for. But it's not like this. We were alone and we had a hard time. And when other breweries arrived doing it, then people started to pay attention. And they were thinking that, okay, it's not only them, the only one brewery doing it, so it's several. So maybe this is smart, maybe this is interesting. And people started to pay attention, and together with these other breweries, like Holmbryggeriet, like Hin, Agit and so on, we were like paving the way together. We were working together to establish the new beer culture in Rome.
And did you have like a main beer, which more or less was the Kerry wagon of the time, or?
I think our IPA, our regular IPA, quite quickly became the best seller. But we fairly quickly started to export beers because in Europe in general, it was not that many breweries at that time. And since we were quite innovative and we were not afraid of making big beers, and I say big, not necessarily only in alcohol, but that could be very expressive in hop, hoppy character, or it could be, you know, properly dark imperial styles, and, you know, real, you know, going all the way. And that was respected fairly quickly. So we ended up exporting a lot of beers to different other markets. And I think in the other markets, people appreciated us for our innovations. They didn't want to have just another IPA or failure. They wanted something, barrel age this or ingredient that, and so on.
Nowadays, we know that Norway also has a great beer history and has that whole quake culture in the southern part or part of the southern part, wherever. Did you already have contact to that beer scene in that time?
Not at all. Not at all. There were, I think at that time, the quake environment, so to speak, the community was isolated in fjords and villages, and they didn't even communicate together. They were like, you know, stuck with their own quake culture. And I think this is also very significant for how quake has developed. Not as one homogenous type of yeast strains, but very different from one valley to the next.
But did you use that later on? So did it have some impact in your work?
Actually, the kite movement started after I left Mergner back in 20, well, I left in 15. And that was the turning point when kite was starting to come. So I've used quake a little bit afterwards, but that is in my brewery in Greece, though, not in Norway.
Okay, so let's go back to the time in Norway. So the company you started, you were breaking the ground for the new beer idea, and then you were getting the old guy, maybe. So how was that development, and when did you decide to leave the company?
I decided to leave probably in 2011, and I sold out in 13 and continued working until 15. Why did I want to leave? Well, because we were several partners, and we had different opinions, and I was a minority, and I thought my other partners wanted to be more commercial. And less innovative and less, how can I say this? I think that craft beer is a lot about people, and we think that it's all about beer, but there's a lot of human interactions there. And to have these relations with people is extremely important. And I thought my partners became more focused on business, profits, financial models, and I thought this is not why I started this. So I had two choices. I could work for their goals, or I could just sell out and leave and do my own thing. I selected the latter.
So
one of these things which happened, just an example, which illustrates what I'm getting at, or the reason for leaving. We used to give yeasts to home brewers. I mean, as a brewery, you have too much yeast, you have a surplus of yeast. And it's sitting there in the bottom of the cone. And if you come at the right time, when it's at the right time to harvest, then we have unlimited amounts of yeast to give away. It's just to show up with, you know, with a sanitary container, and that's fine. And we did that. And then my partners realized that this actually takes some time, a few minutes every time, for the brewer, and the brewer would have to stop what he's doing and go over and sanitize and harvest the yeast. And they said, this is taking too much time, let's just skip it. And overnight, while I was out traveling, because I was traveling a lot, I was like the ambassador for many of the new markets, and I came back, and they all of a sudden they changed certain things. Well, that was one of the things that changed. They said, no more yeast for home brewers. We are rather dumping it in the drain. We don't want to spend all that time, because we don't earn money from it. We need to earn money on everything we do. If we waste maybe 1 hour per week, 2 hours per week by serving home brewers, then that's a waste of time. Let's just skip it. And I think this is so stupid because all these home brewers were super enthusiastic. They were spreading the word about us. They were our ambassadors, our friends. And my partners didn't understand that. That's one example of why I decided to leave.
Yes, that's another story how business can kill the enthusiasm of something, and and success eats it somehow. And so you decided to go to a new adventure, and you went south, which is obvious. So you selected Greece. Why?
Well, me and my wife wanted to have or wanted to look at other things we could ferment. So we had, of course, successfully seen that we could ferment beers and make beers. In 2010, we were the first to make sake commercially in Europe. So sake was one thing we could tick off as, you know, being able to do that. So then we thought perhaps we should go into or make wine. So we bought a vineyard in Greece. Why Greece? Well, because Italy and France is very expensive. Croatia is very Slavic and Eastern European. And we ended up just with Greece and with Crete because we were drawn to the idea of being on an island. And there are not that many islands with great wine production in Greece, but Crete is one of them. So we ended up there for that reason. And then we realized that, hey, there's not much good beers in this country. And we ended up launching a beer brand and investing in a brewery, and then we didn't have time to do anything with the vineyard, so we leased the vineyard to a winery, and that changed everything. But I need to mention to you that parallel to that, I had a project with some friends of mine, old childhood friends, to start a company doing fermented vegetables. So we were looking at not only wines but also fermenting vegetables. Of course, totally different concept with fermenting food instead of fermenting beverage. I'm just mentioning this to you to show that we just wanted to do something new, and it should be about fermentation. And the fermented vegetable project stranded. We had problems with funding, and it's difficult to run a business together, so we realized that we should close the company. So that really never materialized.
But it's another example that you really were ahead of your time, because nowadays fermented vegetable is a big thing. You
know? That is correct. Yeah.
So you more or less went back to beer. And how was that to establish a brewery in Greece, in Crete, as a foreigner, and to build all these legal things and to set up breweries? How was that?
Very challenging. If we knew then all the challenges we would face, then it would not have happened. And that brewery in Crete is not going very well. It's not easy to work with craft beer in Greece in general. And now we're at this point in time where we're leaving it to our employees to just see if they can make it survive, if it has a future. So I've invested 10 years of my life in that brewery project, investing and losing money, and also working 10 years without a salary. And it comes to a point where you realize that this is probably not going anywhere. And that's what I've included about that project.
The name was Solo, or is Solo? Where did that come from?
The brand name is Solo because I felt a little bit disappointed by the fact that my previous partners, ex-partners in Nørgne, had wanted to go new directions. So my wife and I said to ourselves, this is our solo project, and nobody's going to ruin this for us by changing ideas or going in new directions.
And inside Greece, as it is a totally different culture to Norway, as well in the consumers, also in the employees and the whole structure, so did you again have to break walls or to take new ground or to explore new things?
You need to have a totally new mindset about things. In Scandinavia, if you have a good product, high quality, at a good price, with good distribution, that's really everything. In Greece, it's more about relations. You know, for how long time have we been knowing each other and working together, and whether the quality of the product is great or not doesn't really matter. It's a matter of working with whom you know, and strengthen relationships. So it's a different mindset. And yeah, there are many, many challenges. Also, the Greek government is a little bit unpredictable. Changes in legislation can happen overnight, even retroactive. Like from 2 weeks ago, you should have done this. And we're not, we didn't know then, but we're telling you now. And if you don't do that, we'll fine you heavily. Fines are extremely high for not complying with regulations in Greece. So it's a very tough country to work in for many reasons. One is the business culture. And for the beer industry, when you issue an invoice to a client, there's no pay by date. There's no date for the invoice to be paid. Because that's unfriendly. Hey, we're friends, right? You can, you don't do that to friends. So you give an invoice, and then after a week or two, then the salesperson would probably call or visit. You cannot send a text message or an email. No, that's not friendly. So you show up or you call and say, you know what, that invoice I gave you a couple of weeks ago, maybe it's time to pay that. And then usually the answer is, yeah, next week I'll pay half of it. And then the week after we can discuss how we will do the payment for the remaining of the sum. So it's like a never-ending process, and in this country, in Greece, there's so much energy and time. I would like to say that use the word wasted, which is wasted because there's nothing really good coming out of it. It's something we in the north of Europe, we just have a pay-by date, and it's, you know, you put it in your internet banking system, and it goes on time, and there's nothing to discuss really. But in Greece, it's an issue which consumes a lot of time and energy.
And I guess it's not like this on the other side, if you buy raw materials or equipment or...
No, this is typical for the hospitality industry, for beverages and restaurant business.
But climate and life was nice?
Climate and life is nice. And as I just said, people pay attention to relations. So it means that when you have a business meeting, then you need to allocate enough time for it, because after you've had some coffees, maybe you go out for lunch and then you go out to have some raki, and it takes a while, you know. And you can look at it many ways. You can look at it as a waste of time. We need to I must spend my time wisely to be efficient. Or you can look at it the other way. Let's have a good time at the same time, you know, with good people, because there are, of course, a lot of good people everywhere. And in the Greek culture, people are good at focusing on that. They're enjoying themselves while they're doing business.
So you now put your focus away from Crete. So what is your new project and new ideas that you're planning on?
Well, technically, I'm retired. I was lucky to leave the airline business before they changed the retirement age to 65, so I'm a young retiree, so to speak.
Okay, so you still get a pension from the...
So I have a pension, and I can do whatever I want. And since I don't spend much time in Greece anymore, then I invest my time in two things. Well, for beer-related stuff, I focus on beer judging, doing 5 to 6 competitions internationally every year, which I enjoy a lot. It's like, as you very well know, the community of beer judges is almost like a big family.
It's fantastic, it?
And also I picked up some studies. I mean, I've never done anything academic in my life, and I think now is the time. So I picked up studies, and I study Orthodox theology.
Wow.
So I'm thinking, this is just me putting things into system. We all like systems, don't we? So the first 20 years of my life, it was, of course, about the basic education. The next 20 years of my life was about being an airline pilot. Then the following 20 years of my life was in craft beer. And if we live to average life expectation, we only have 80 years on this planet. So there's 20 more years after that. And I tried to dedicate that to more academic approach and spiritual things. And I think changing direction in what you're doing through life is probably healthy from a perspective of your mind and developing yourself.
When was the last time you were flying a plane?
I was in 2010. It's a long time ago.
So you don't have a small one like in Norway?
No, I don't. That was a Boeing 737. I was I most of my time my career I did long haul flights on wide body aircraft, but I finished the last few years as a captain on 737s flying European routes.
Does this change your mindset if you are always above the clouds and close to heaven, let's say like this, and but also responsible for all these people and for the airplane? Is this something that impacts you as a human?
Of course it does. It's it's a lot of responsibility. Well, it's a the totally honest response to your question is that as a co-pilot, I had a much more relaxed mentality. Of course, I knew that I had to do my job and do it well and do it correctly, but the ultimate responsibility is not with me, it's with the captain. And so as a co-pilot, I enjoy flying around the world, intercontinental routes, and I just had a ball of time. Becoming a captain was much more serious, and you're focusing on it even, you know, a couple of days before you go to work, because you know what you're doing, you have to have the right mindset, you need to, it's about responsibility, which one should, of course, not take lightly, but it's more serious.
And you could transfer a lot of that maybe to the 2 year later work in the beer world, I think, being the captain of the company, also responsible.
Of course. Yeah.
Maybe last question, what do you think is the difference between, let's say, a good brewer and a great brewer?
I'm laughing because that question came as a total surprise. There are two ways to look at it. If you look at the brewer as a scientist, because a brewer is both a scientist and an artist.
Yeah.
If you look at the brewer as a scientist, of course, the great brewer is the brewer who would go in depth and do the extra research and read more about it and have more knowledge. But then if you look at the brewer as an artist, then that's the brewer who says, I'm not afraid of anything. I'll dare to do that crazy thing, that crazy idea, and I'll just see how it works. That's a great brewer from an artistic perspective. And really the best brewer is one brewer who would have one foot in the science world and one foot in the artist's world and balance both of that at the same time.
Perfect. So thank you very much for your time, for the information, and I really wish you all the best for the next brew on a high level.
Thanks, Markus. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
Beer Talk, der Podcast rund ums Bier. Alle Folgen unter www.biertalk.de.